Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
We are diving into a scientific controversy that has really been kicking around the world of material science for nearly a century. And that is figuring out the precise mechanism of the bainite transformation in steel.
It's a classic example of a checkered history in scientific theory. I mean, it really is. For decades, the observations that just didn't align with the prevailing wisdom.
So what were they seeing versus what they were expecting?
Well, imagine seeing physical deformation, like the material is actually moving, when you expected a purely chemical reaction. For years, the default but ultimately mistaken belief was that bainite was just, a type of non-lamellar eutectoid.
And in simple terms, that means.
It means they thought it formed without any participation of mechanical shear, even when experiments were clearly showing the material was physically moving and changing shape.
So it looked like a standard chemical change, but it acted like a physical, almost forceful movement, a material science enigma. And you might be asking, why does this arcane debate about what happens inside a piece of hot steel matter to me?
Well, it matters because resolving this mechanism gives us quantitative predictive power. The closure between theory and, credible experiments has directly enabled the engineering of new commercial steels.
We're talking about real-world applications here.
Absolutely, including the world's first bulk nanostructured steel. These are the materials that are underpinning massive infrastructure projects. I mean, we are talking about steel that has supported more than 1 billion gross tons of traffic.
Wow.
So if you want high-performance materials, you need to know exactly how their structure forms.
Absolutely. So our mission today is to follow that definitive evidence trail. We're going to explore the scientific consensus detailing the exact accepted mechanism. And maybe more importantly, we're going to critically examine and disprove the alternative diffusion models that simply, well, don't hold up.
So let's start with the central accepted truth of it all. The transformation from the face-centered cubic austenite phase, the Gauss phase, to the body-centered bainitic ferrite, or AuB, is fundamentally displacive.
Displacive, that's the crucial word. In plain language, that means the structure isn't waiting for atoms to slowly diffuse into new positions.
No, not at all.
The atoms are being abruptly shoved into a new configuration, which is, I mean, the definition of shear.
Precisely. It's a movement-based, composition-invariant lattice change.
Yeah.
And the physical deformation it causes is massive and highly organized. We aren't talking about a subtle wiggle.
So what does that movement look like? Can we visualize the scale of this atomic shift?
Yeah, we can. It involves a very distinct and reproducible shape deformation, a shear strain of roughly 0.26 that runs parallel to the thin plate of ferrite being created.
Okay.
And that's combined with a uniaxial expansion of about 0.03 that goes normal or, straight out from that plane.
Think of it like a specialized wedge being hammered into the steel matrix.
That's a great way to put it, yeah.
And that sounds like a powerful enough physical force to leave a mark. Did experiments confirm this wasn't just some surface effect?
They did, emphatically. Experiments back in the mid-century showed that as these bainite plates grew, they physically displaced pre-existing boundaries in the austenite around them.
Like twin boundaries.
Specifically, twin boundaries. And since those boundaries run deep into the crystal, it proved that the deformation is a true bulk effect. It confirmed the shear mechanism.
I see.
But what's truly fascinating is the geometry of the final structure. The characteristic thin plate shape of bainite isn't just some random
You know,
feature.
it's a necessity.
It's a physical necessity, yeah. It's driven by the need to minimize the incredibly high strain energy that's created by that 0.26 shear deformation.
So the shape is a result of the steel attempting to self-soothe its own internal mechanical stress. That makes perfect sense. And if the steel is transforming via this displacement, the boundary between the old phase and the new phase must be moving incredibly efficiently.
It has to be. We call the interface responsible for this displacive change glissol.
Glissol, so highly movable.
Almost friction-free. And if you zoom in, this interface is a highly specialized contact layer made of dislocations. You have these monoatomic height coherency dislocations, which manage the rotation and distortion.
Okay.
And then you have anti-coherency dislocations, which accommodate the long-range strain fields for the overall shear movement. It's a highly sophisticated machinery layer, really.
It enables that high-speed atomic rearrangement without needing atoms to jump places through diffusion.
That's the key.
So once we accept that fundamental mechanical movement, it leads us to the biggest puzzle. Since bainite is structurally so similar to martensite, Why does the reaction suddenly just stop?
Yes.
This brings us to the thermodynamics of it
and
the incomplete reaction phenomenon, or IRP.
This is where we bridge the mechanical view with the chemical one. Mm-hmm. And the conceptual breakthrough here came from Heman. He established that bainite grows like martensite, that initial lattice shift is diffusionless. But crucially, after the transformation, the excess carbon is rejected. It partitions into the surrounding austenite.
Right. And we know that for that initial diffusionless growth to even happen, the process has to stay below a critical thermodynamic threshold.
Exactly. That threshold is the T temperature. T is the line in the sand where the two phases have identical free energy. For transformation to occur, the temperature has to be low enough that the free energy of the new bainitic ferrite is less than the austenite.
Assuming they have the same chemical composition.
The exact same composition. That's the condition.
But if it's like martensite, why is it called the incomplete reaction phenomenon? Martensite transformation, once it starts, tends to go until you run out of material or change the temperature. It doesn't just stop mid-process.
That's the key difference. Because bainite forms at slightly higher temperatures, there is just enough time for the displaced carbon to quickly move out of the new ferrite and pile up in the residual austenite.
And this carbon enrichment raises the energy barrier.
Because the reaction ceases, it stops dead when that residual austenite becomes so enriched in carbon that it reaches what we call the X prime T rho concentration.
So the material essentially poisons its own reaction with carbon until it hits a point where any more shear movement is thermodynamically impossible.
That's it. It runs out of available free energy to drive the shear mechanism forward.
It's like an atomic level engine that stalls when its fuel, the free energy difference, just drops to zero.
Precisely. The transformation physically cannot proceed without external input.
Now, this is where the theory moved from a clever idea to definitive proof. We weren't just taking an educated guess anymore.
We certainly aren't. We have overwhelming quantitative validation. Across more than 150 meticulously controlled experiments, researchers have confirmed that the transformation stops precisely when the austenite carbon concentration hits that calculated T value.
The numbers match up exactly.
The measured carbon concentration matches the thermodynamic prediction. It shows that the T limit is the ruling condition that stops the transformation, not some kinetic process like the interface slowing down.
That's a powerful validation, and it has massive practical relevance. Engineers are using this knowledge right now.
Routinely. This predictive thermodynamic framework is integral to modern steel design. For instance, in quench and partitioning, or Q&P, steels, or when they're designing additively manufactured bainitic components.
Right.
Engineers use this framework to precisely control the amount of carbon enrichment in the austenite, which in turn controls the final mechanical stability of the part.
Before we move on, there's one subtle but really important detail about that carbon buildup in the austenite that's left over. Is it, you know, evenly distributed?
No, and this is critical. The distribution is highly heterogeneous.
Meaning it's patchy.
Very patchy. The displacive transformation happens so much faster than the time required for the carbon to homogenize by diffusion. So you end up with these pockets of highly enriched, isolated austenite that might be ultra stable, sitting right next to other areas that are still ready to transform maybe later on into martensite.
Okay, so if we accept the robust evidence for the displacive mechanism, we have to address the models that still insist on significant diffusion during the actual growth process.
We do. And the fundamental objection, the one that makes diffusion models functionally impossible, it really just comes down to atomic mobility.
The temperatures are just too low for atoms to rearrange themselves on the scale required for that kind of growth.
They are. I mean, bainite has been successfully obtained in the lab at temperatures as low as 125 degrees Celsius.
That's incredibly cool for steel transformation.
It is. And if we look at the required time scales and temperatures, the calculated maximum diffusion distance for a large iron atom is an almost inconceivable 10 to the minus 17 meters.
Hold on. 10 to the minus 17 meters. That number is just impossible to grasp. Can you give us a scale?
Let's put it this way. If you were to scale up a single iron atom to the size of planet Earth, the distance that atom could travel at 125 degrees over the experimental time would still be less than the width of a human hair.
Wow. Okay, that's how locked in the structure is.
That's right. Christian's tenet is proven here. Any acceptable theory must account for the virtual lack of large substitutional solute atom mobility at these formation temperatures.
And that includes all the bigger alloying elements engineers love to use, like molybdenum and chromium. they are frozen solid.
Absolutely frozen. And high-resolution atom probe experiments, they give us the ultimate visual proof. They confirm that substitutional solutes do not partition or segregate at the bainite interface during the transformation.
They're configurationally frozen.
That's the term. Even when cementite, one of the secondary products, starts to form later, the big atoms, the solutes, are trapped inside, and they maintain the exact same ratio they started with in the austenite.
So how do these diffusion-based models try to explain this frozen state? Let's tackle the negligible partitioning local equilibrium model, the MPLE model. What was it trying to achieve?
Well, MPLE was an attempt to find a middle ground. It accepted that the big atoms don't move long distances, but it proposed that there was still this tiny localized chemical balancing happening right at the interface.
Maintaining local equilibrium, this sort of chemical compromise. But why did it fail?
Because for MPLE to work, it requires the existence of ultra-sharp concentration spikes of substitutional solutes like manganese in the austenite right ahead of the interface.
Okay.
And when metallurgists ran the numbers, the calculations for these necessary spikes yielded physically impossible widths, sometimes only 0.002 to 0.04 nanometers wide.
That's less than the size of an atom.
Exactly. The energy required to create those sharp variations, what we call the gradient energy cost, is just astronomically high. It effectively rules out MPLE as a viable physical mechanism.
That is a stunning failure of the numbers. Okay, what about the other major historical idea, the WBS line and this concept of solute drag?
The WBS line was an attempt to establish an empirical limit based on carbon concentration, but it's now been deemed to have an invalid foundation.
Why is that?
It originated from an older plate lengthening theory put forth by Hilliard that itself failed to accurately match measured growth data. So relying on that is just unjustified.
And as for solute drag?
The idea that solutes are slowing the interface down. Right. First principles calculations now show this effect is deemed insignificant at bainite forming temperatures. The energy required to overcome solute drag just rapidly drops to nearly zero when you enter that temperature range.
So we have definitive proof that the transformation front is mechanical, not chemical, and that the big atoms are frozen, which leads us to the final brilliant piece of the puzzle. If the transformation front rejects the carbon, why is the resulting bainitic ferrite full of carbon long after the transformation is complete? This is the mystery of supersaturated carbon.
It is the extraordinary vestige of diffusionless transformation. The bainitic ferrite contains carbon concentrations far exceeding traditional equilibrium levels, and it persists in solid solution for extremely long times. I mean, we're talking 250 hours, even at a relatively high 200 degrees C.
So it's not just that the carbon is too slow to move. Something is actively holding it in place.
Something is holding it. And this final lock and key detail links right back to the original movement we talked about in the first section.
A shear itself.
It does. The carbon is locked in due to the internal structure caused by the Bain strain. That transformation shear physically leaves the carbon atoms ordered in just one of the three possible sublattices of the interstices.
Okay, so it forces them into a specific pattern.
A very specific pattern. And this ordering forces the unit cell of the ferrite to become tetragonal. It's a slightly asymmetric crystal structure.
A structural change like that must fundamentally change the chemical rules for that specific material, doesn't it?
It has to. And this new, more stable equilibrium now between the body-centered tetragonal ferrite and the austenite, it significantly increases the carbon solubility within that ferrite.
It's a self-stabilizing effect.
It is. And it explains why that high concentration can persist for such extended periods. It resolves the final chemical anomaly using the mechanical origin.
It all comes together.
If we connect all these findings, the unified quantitative understanding now places bainite, that's IB, Widmanstetten ferrite, Ibigue and martensite on a continuum.
They're three siblings in the same family.
They are. They're all part of the same family of displacive transformations.
They share mechanical DNA, so to speak.
They do. All of them exhibit that specific invariant plane strain shape deformation. And the substitutional to iron atom ratio remains unchanged from the parent austenite in all three.
And the nucleation is similar, too.
Even the highly complex dislocation-dissociation mechanism required for nucleation is similar, showing a linear dependence of the activation energy on the driving force.
So the ability to define bainite so thoroughly means we can now predict all three of those transformations with a high degree of certainty. What does that mean for engineers building alloys today?
It means we can design alloys not just empirically, but predictively. Since the mechanics and the thermodynamics are so well understood and quantified, it's now possible to calculate whether all three or fewer of these transformations are physically possible in a given alloy based on the available driving force and stored energy.
And this is being used now.
Oh, absolutely. This capability forms the core of free, accessible computer programs used globally for steel design. It allows us to hit really precise performance targets.
So what does this all mean? The long and controversial history of the Bainite transformation mechanism has, it seems, reached definitive closure.
I say so.
The mechanism is fundamentally displaced. Its termination is governed strictly by that TR thermodynamic limit, and the structural anomaly of the resulting bainitic ferrite is stabilized by this fascinating tetragonal carbon ordering.
Which is caused by the initial mechanical shear.
The science is settled.
It is, and the theoretical basis, supported by that sheer volume of quantitative data, is exceptionally robust.
Which leads to a final provocative thought, drawn straight from the source material itself. Given this clarity and this new level of predictive power, the community may now need to reconsider the role of empirical fitting versus fundamental theory. Perhaps it's time to avoid starting new publications with the statement that bainite is controversial, therefore.
I agree completely. It reminds us of the critical difference between calculation and understanding. As the physicist P.W. Anderson once commented, the perfect computation simply reproduces nature, does not explain her.
Right here, we've done both.
We have. We have not only reproduced the behavior of bainite, but explained the fundamental physical reasons behind it, securing the value of theory for the next century of materials innovation.